There's apparently another type of foul play at work in the food world, olive oil fraud. A new study from the University of California at Davis claims more than two-thirds of random samples of imported extra virgin olive oil don't meet the extra virgin standard. From Capital Public Radio, Elaine Korn reports.
The Olive Oil Chemistry Lab is on the Davis campus. It overlooks many of the campus's 2,000 olive trees. Managing the lab's olive oil forensics is chemist Charles Shoemaker.
We have our own CSI olive oil lab here.
To be extra virgin, it can't be rancid, adulterated with cheap refined olive oil, or doctored up, cut, with lesser oils. Shoemaker wasn't all that surprised that many of the 14 major brands tested failed certain tests.
It's become a very sophisticated practice, the adulteration of olive oil throughout the world.
The lab says it can prove defects, degradation, and dilution in olive oil beyond what human taste buds can figure out. Shoemaker zeroes in on specific flaws.
We do spectroscopic studies looking for oxidation.
That means the oil's old or rancid. Shoemaker also tests fatty acids.
To make sure the oil is all from olives and not from soybean, sunflower, or other types of oils.
No molecule can hide. Shoemaker revs up a small vacuum. It removes solvents and isolates chlorophyll, which is always an oil made from green olives, but never in lesser grade seed oil. As it sucks a sample, he's patient.
It takes about 25 minutes per sample to do just this one step.
The UC Davis study was funded in part by the California Olive Oil Council. Oils were tested by some methods not yet recognized by international standards, and for that reason, Bob Bauer of the North American Olive Oil Association, which represents importers, disputes the Davis study.
It's irresponsible to create the misperception that they've done based on unrecognized tests. These results directly contradict our 20 years of more extensive sampling and what those results show.
There's never been a legal definition in the U.S. for any grade of olive oil. Mounting concern over truth in olive oil labeling has drawn in the USDA. New American regulations will conform to international standards. Olive oil from every olive oil producing country, including America, will be subject to random sampling off retail shelves starting in October, using a lab in Georgia. For NPR News, I'm Elaine Korn in Sacramento.
This is NPR News. A delegation of American Jewish leaders is back from Israel this weekend. They were there to oppose a bill in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset. The group is worried that the bill would give Orthodox religious authorities in Israel the power to judge which conversions to Judaism are legitimate, and therefore which converted Jews are eligible for Israeli citizenship. Jerry Silverman is one of the leaders who went to Israel. He's the president of the Jewish Federations of North America, and he joins us on the phone. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can you tell us briefly what this bill will do if it passes the Knesset?
It specifically hands the Orthodox-run chief rabbinate full authority over all conversion in Israel for the first time. Further, the bill, if enacted, could end up threatening the eligibility to become Israeli citizens of some immigrants who have converted to Judaism. And it boils down to a vital and an existential question for Jews in the U.S. Does the Jewish state belong to all Jews?
It would mainly have an effect on Reform and conservative Jews in the United States?
We believe this bill will have a direct effect and could have a direct effect based on its ambiguity to all movements of Jews, Reform, conservative, Reconstructionist, and potentially some Orthodox Jews.
So this issue is more than just about conversion.
This issue is about conversion from a specific point, but it is a broader point in that the Jewish state in 1948, and if you look at the original words of the Constitution that was written, is that it's a Jewish state for all Jews. And this law truly can create a discriminating factor to really create two different levels of Jews and the way we're looked at around the world.
Hmm. And in terms of whether or not you can become an Israeli citizen.
Correct.
Yeah. The bill has already passed through committee, and it needs to be voted on by the Knesset. The Knesset adjourned for its three-month summer break without addressing the bill. The sponsor of the bill, he's been quoted as saying American Jews are using their power to interfere in internal Israeli affairs. Your organization usually tries to stay out of political disputes. Why is it important for you to get involved in this particular issue?
There have been two times in history that the Jewish federations have gotten involved with issues in Israel in the political environment. Both of those times dealt with the question of law of return and who is a Jew. This issue is in the bullseye of both of those. And we, as the Jewish Federations in North America, will not stand back and watch this happen. We will get into it, and we will do our best to ensure that the Jewish state is for all the Jewish people.
Jerry Silverman is the president of the Jewish Federations of North America. He and a delegation of other American Jewish leaders have returned from Israel this weekend. He joined us by phone. Thank you very much.
You're so welcome.
Author Peter Heller has followed eco-pirates to the Antarctic Sea to duel with Japanese whaling fleets. He's journeyed through the belly of the deepest Tibetan gorge. But it wasn't until he got into surfing that he found himself in over his head.
Surfing is one of the only pursuits on Earth that can drub you into numb exhaustion and blunt trauma time and again and give you nothing in return. Nothing but sand in your crotch, salt-stung eyes, banged temple, chipped tooth, screaming back and sunburned ears. Gives you all of this and not a single stand-up ride, time and again, day after day. Gives you nothing back but tumbles, wipeouts, thumpings, scares, and you return. You're glad to do it. In fact, you can think of nothing you'd rather do.
Heller is a travel writer from Denver, and his latest book is called Kook, What Surfing Taught Me About Love, Life, and Catching the Perfect Wave. Peter Heller joins me now from the studios at KCFR in Denver at Colorado Public Radio. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so I'm going to start off with what I hope is not an insult, but to say that this whole surfing idea actually started with a midlife crisis, right?
Yep, it did. I had finished this expedition through the Tsangpo Gorge, which was, you know, thoroughly exhausting, and written a book about it, which was also exhausting in its own way. And I was kind of sitting on my porch in Denver watching the spring snow sweep over the mountains thinking, you know, what am I going to do next? You know, I just did this big thing, you know, now am I supposed to do another big thing, or could I just do some little things for a while? And the phone rang, and it was a friend of mine who was a corporate lawyer. He'd been transferred from Chicago, where he was very happy, to Huntington Beach, Surf City, USA. And he asked me if I would come out and learn to surf with him.
And what I love about this is you guys basically just buy the shorts, buy the board, and show up at the beach and kind of assume we'll be able to take this up pretty quickly. And this is where you first hear the term kook, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, taking your board and trotting into the water at Huntington Beach would be sort of like, you know, you and I saying, let's go to Yankee Stadium, you know, hit some balls with the Yankees. It's, you know, it's just not done, but we didn't know. So, yeah, within like 5 minutes, I had a surfer with like a snake tattoo on his neck yelling at me, you bleeping kook, get the bleep out of the water, you know, or I'm going to bleep you up. And kind of hurt my feelings, really.
Well, what's the definition of that term? Give us the full sense, full impact of what was being hurled your way.
Yeah, kook. I mean, it's a beginner, but it's not a neutral term. I mean, it's a clueless, hopeless beginner. It's the guy that paddles up to the other surfers at the lineup who are very quiet, you know, and just chatters away like it's a cocktail party and, you know, gives a rebel yell when he does manage to stand up for a split second and drops in on people, you know, when it's not his wave, cuts people off and collides and basically is just a menace. And And that was me.
What gave you the idea to go from being a complete kook to essentially at least not embarrassing yourself in front of the pros in 6 months? Because you decided to take out a six-month chunk of time.
Right. I mean, that's what I had. You know, I figured I could drop everything for 6 months and get away with it. And I bought an old Vanagon, and I thought, well, you know, could I go from kook to riding like a big fast wave like you see in the movies in 6 months at my age? I was 47 when I started. And I also at the same time knew that I was a kook in relationships. And, you know, I hadn't had much luck in that area. And so I invited the woman that I was dating at the time, who was just the greatest woman. I just thought she was, you know, I loved her. And I thought, you know, if I invite her and we go on this trip down the coast of Mexico and try and learn from experts along the way, and I thought if I invite her, you know, maybe, you know, I can get to know her. And maybe, you know, I can actually learn, you know, how to love someone else while I learn to surf.
You really kind of put yourself out there with that.
I don't know. I can't think of anything better to do than share, you know, our vulnerabilities and share our own truths, you know, as we write. That's what I try and do. But so I did that, you know, I invited her, you know, the surf, the love story. And then, you know, I found that there's this whole other element to the surf deal, which is, you know, the oceans are in big trouble. And that started to really dawn on me at the same time.
Now, as a journalist, you've covered whaling, pirates, and the sea, but all of this has been, I guess, essentially from the surface. And in this book, you're not in a boat. I mean, you're in the water. You're actually, at one point, I think, hanging out with sea lions. Talk about how surfing actually changed the way you see the ocean.
I mean, if you're a kook, the best thing you can do is go out basically in the dark, you know, as early as possible before other people get out there, before you have to compete for the wave. And it's also the most beautiful time, you know, on the coast. So Kim and I would wake up in the dark, you know, we'd turn on the little propane stove, boil water, make instant coffee, you know, slap on some sunscreen, which is kind of weird to do in the dark, and then, you know, paddle out into the waves just as the light is coming up and getting that kind of grainy gray look. And then you're out there, you know, sitting on these swells, you're rising and falling easily on your board. It's the feeding time, so pelicans probably and terns, maybe some blue-footed boobies are diving into the water, you know, corkscrewing and plunging into the water around you with these splashes and coming up with fish. Sardines are skipping over the water or smelt, and maybe a sea turtle lifts her head, and, you know, the mountains start to kind of outline themselves inland, you know, the Sierra, and the sun starts to rise, and there's a wind coming off the shore, and it's just, you know, it's intoxicating, and it's so beautiful, and there's something about being on the ocean that way, you know, on a surfboard, you know, lying down on a surfboard. You feel this, you know, communion with the ocean, and the wave, the surfing part actually becomes, for me, it became sort of like the cream, you know, it was like, that's cool that you could actually catch a wave and surf also, you know, on top of this.
Now, not to give away the ending here, but you actually now live on a lake or near a lake in Denver. And I was actually pretty surprised because I didn't think you'd walk away from surfing.
Listen, I got a partner, which was the best thing in the world. And that's partly what the whole story is about. And also, I think, you know, it's interesting about surfing. I mean, you go out every day. And you're not looking for a life lesson. You're just trying to catch a frigging wave. And every day you have to totally commit to something that seems kind of in your brain, seems insane, which is to throw yourself, you know, over the lip of something that looks, you know, like a wall. And you have to totally commit. You have to let go to a power that's greater than you. And I think, you know, those are really good things to practice, you know, if you want to live with someone else and have a good relationship. So they get drummed into you every day without, you know, meaning to.
Peter Heller is a travel writer from Denver, and his latest book is called Kook, What Surfing Taught Me About Love, Life, and Catching the Perfect Wave. He joins us from our studios at KCFR in Denver at Colorado Public Radio. Peter, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
We turn now to Eric Pooley. He's the author of the book, The Climate War, True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Planet. And he says that not only did the oil spill complicate the political situation, but President Obama missed an opportunity.
Obama and the Democratic leaders had dreamed of a grand bargain that would include a cap on carbon emissions, as well as expanded offshore drilling, expanded nuclear power subsidies, and expanded advanced coal technology, or so-called clean coal, as sweeteners to get the cap through. So after the oil spill took offshore drilling off the table, if you will, that grand bargain became harder to strike. That said, Obama didn't tell people directly where they should take their anger and frustration over the spill. In other words, he didn't say, here's where we need to go to solve this problem. Here's how we have to get off oil because of this sea monster on the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico that's spewing 60 or 70,000 barrels a day. He left out the what we need to do part.
And it seems as though you didn't see the same kind of campaign-style push for a climate change bill the way you saw it with health care.
Nothing remotely similar. The president and his political advisors made a decision to pursue what they called a stealth strategy on this issue, even though I think they knew it was going to be woefully inadequate. In order to get this done, Obama would have had to engage on three levels in a very deep and sustained way. On the level of public messaging, on the level of policy, to really get down in the weeds, pick a bill, a specific set of proposals, and drive it, and then on the level of good old-fashioned politicking. And he didn't do any of those three things.
It's interesting that you talk about the public image part, because there was a little bit of an attempt anyway at branding. Sometimes you heard energy legislation connected with green jobs. Other times you heard it described as energy legislation instead of climate change. And the only thing that really seemed to stick was energy tax. And that was from the GOP and Republicans and folks who were against what the Democrats were pushing for.
Well, nobody in support of the bill had the same kind of megaphone that the opponents had other than Obama. The green groups and the senators who were pushing climate action, they can't compete with Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck, if you will.
But do they have the same cohesiveness of mission, even? I mean,
doesn't energy
and climate change and all these different things, don't they mean different things even to these groups?
Well, I think the goal is the same, but the approaches are different. And I think you're absolutely right, Audie. Here on the right, you had sustained, unified opposition. They were all singing from the same choir book. On the left, you had people who thought a carbon tax would be better than a cap. You had a whole bunch of different opinions. This bill's not strong enough. You had enviros who wanted to hold out for something stronger, even though that was obviously unachievable. In fact, I think the environmentalists made a serious strategic error by not waking up and smelling the coffee in the fall of 2009 and pulling back then to the compromise position that they ended up trying to put through in the last few weeks, which was a scaled-down bill that would only cap emissions from the power sector. If they had started negotiating that a year ago, they might have gotten it done. But they held out for an economy-wide cap until it was too late, and they ended up with nothing.
Eric, at the start of the year, President Obama went to climate change talks in Copenhagen and promised that the U.S. would cut its greenhouse gas emissions by as much as 17% in the next 10 years. So how can the administration work towards those goals now?
Well, it's a tragic moment because the best way to do it was through legislative action, and Obama knew that but wasn't willing to fight for it.
So what is he left with?
He's left with the EPA and the courts. Now, the EPA is moving ahead with regulation of stationary sources, that's large power plants, et cetera, that emit huge amounts of CO2, and that will end up with what Representative John Dingell memorably called a glorious mess of litigation. In effect, the utilities decided that they would rather wait and fight this in the courts than have a cap that only applied to the utility industry. And now the environmentalists are saying, bring it on. If we can't solve this in the legislative process, we will fight you in the courts. And what you're going to see is skirmishing over coal plant after coal plant after coal plant. And it's going to be protracted and ugly.
Eric Pooley is the deputy editor of Bloomberg Businessweek and author of The Climate Wars. Eric, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. This weekend, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, or NACA, brought its Save the Dream tour to the Convention Center here in Washington, D.C. With lenders by its side, the group helps homeowners modify their mortgages to the point that they're affordable. But as NPR's Tamara Keith reports, one major bank has left the tour.
There are hundreds of tables set up in the convention center. Bank representatives and homeowners sit face to face. They're sorting through paperwork, talking about income and interest rates. And in some cases, they're able to settle on new loan terms right there. When that happens, the homeowners go up to a podium in the center of the room.
All right, NACA, NACA. We have another great testimony on the stage coming from Bank of America.
Edith Lomtake grabs the microphone to tell her story.
My rate was 7.8. It was reduced down to 3.75, and so I'm very, very happy.
But you won't hear any testimonials like this from Chase customers. Earlier this year, the bank stopped coming to NACA events. Instead, Chase sets up shop in nearby hotels wherever NACA goes. It's sort of a shadow tour. The reasons aren't entirely clear. Bruce Marks is CEO of NACA.
They ended up leaving, you know, and they don't like it that we go and we storm their corporate offices, and they don't like it that we take over their annual meetings. They don't like that we hold them personally responsible for the devastation that they're causing.
It's safe to say there's no love lost between Chase and the often combative NACA. At a hotel less than a mile away, about 50 Chase employees talk to customers about their loans. April Brown is one of those customers. She got a ride over in a NACA shuttle.
I've been going through this since 2008 and trying to get answers, trying to get things resituated and resolved. And I'm hoping today that a solution will come out of it by me being here face to face.
A bank employee promises she'll hear something within 72 hours. Tom Kelly, a Chase spokesman, says the bank doesn't do the flashy same-day solutions you'd see at a NACA event. He says they want to make the right decisions, and that can take time. Kelly says holding a separate event is better for Chase and its customers.
We can get them in and out very quickly. It's a very streamlined, simple process. We think it works well for our customers.
For both NACA and Chase, this stop on the tour lasts through the end of the week. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.